Hello and welcome to the Citywire Trust Show. Today we are joined in the studio by Mike Seidenberg, manager of the £2 billion Allianz Technology Trust. Allianz Tech is one of the standout funds for the past decade, beating almost all other investment trusts and open-ended funds with a near 900% return over the past 10 years. And with artificial intelligence dominating market conversation, the tech space is looking potentially more growthy than ever. Welcome to the show.
Great to be here.
Yeah, obviously, as mentioned there, there's a lot of excitement in the tech space at the moment. Loads of some really big IPOs lined up. One of the biggest ones, obviously, SpaceX. You know, should that come to market, is that something that you might be interested in potentially investing in?
Yeah, we'll definitely look at it. I mean, just to give you a sense of just the excitement around it, I was recently at the Morgan Stanley Tech Conference, and when they presented, not only did they fill a ballroom, they filled two overflow rooms, which is just unheard of, just from an investor perspective. Look, I think that there are aspects of their business that are super interesting. I'm interested in Starlink. Just anecdotally, the number of people that I speak with that are going to subscribe surprises me. We actually, in the trust, we own a rocket company that we think is a beneficiary of the SpaceX IPO. So that's something that's kind of already in the fund. But we're going to look at it. I mean, ultimately, what we need to do to figure out is, does the risk reward make sense for our investors? And that's, one of the things and one of the hallmarks of how we run the trust, and we've run it from day one. So I'm not going to buy something just because it's, the best thing on the shelf. I'm going to buy something that we think our investors are going to benefit from over a multi-year time period. So it just depends on the valuation.
Yeah. Oh, I mean, by the sounds of it, they're targeting a very high valuation.
Yeah, I know. It seemed kind of crazy. It seems a little bit crazy to me, but what do I know?
Yeah. Well, like you say, judging by the amount of people that you speak to who are interested, do you think it's reasonable that they could sort of reach that market price?
There's definitely an element of scarcity with respect to a large IPO like that, where they're going to raise a lot of money and it's going to span across lots of different sectors, lots of different funds that could potentially invest in it. So I wouldn't be surprised. I think what they've done, let's put the stock aside. I think as a human, just what they've been able to accomplish is incredibly exciting. I think it's, just the thought of when you watch a rocket, the rocket land, it's just kind of mind-boggling to me. And maybe it's just because I'm kind of really super interested in technology and engineering and stuff like that. But it's an exciting company, no doubt about it.
Yeah. Obviously, you mentioned you've got one rocket company already.
Sure.
What do you think about the wider space, the space technology? Is that something you see becoming bigger? Until a year ago, it seemed kind of niche, but now
Definitely it feels like a sector where they are the beneficiaries of technology. And then they have, a lot of demand from the likes of numerous companies wanting to put satellites into orbit. So I think it kind of plays along that curve of more, better chips, smaller form factors, and that really makes the economics. Because remember, when you launch a rocket, it's all about weight. I think it's exciting. I think it's definitely a sector that we're spending time on.
Yeah. How about some of these other IPOs, sort of OpenAI, Anthropic, Databricks?
That
rumored, but they're sort of potentially within your kind of stable of sort of AI at the moment. Are those things you'd be quite interested in?
I mean, they're definitely company. Look, I think that, when you look at just the numbers that we've read, whether it's Anthropic, OpenAI, Databricks, the growth is just really, really commendable, and you just don't see companies at their scale growing like they are. So there's clearly something there. We'll do the work. In the case of OpenAI, we go way back with the CFO. She's been a friend of mine. I've worked with her when she was at Goldman Sachs. So I'm excited for Sarah. She's done a great job there. Here again, we will do our diligence. We'll model the business, and then we'll kind of figure out whether it makes sense from a risk reward perspective to participate or not.
Yeah, yeah. All of these are targeting very high valuations, you know, trillions of pounds.
That's the game of the IPO game.
But if they all do come to market within quite quick succession of one another, do you think there is sort of like enough money in the market at the moment to absorb all of those?
It's a really good question. And I think the answer is yes for most. I mean, these are the ones that we've talked about are very high quality companies. You know, Wall Street unfortunately has this kind of, you know, mantra when they take the really good ones public. Sometimes they take the what I would consider more kind of tier B companies public, you know, depending on the receptivity. So, you know, we'll have to see. But, I think it's the right question, which is what does it mean to the existing public companies? Does it take dollars out of those companies that are going to basically funnel into some of these larger IPOs just from a market cap perspective? Because they're going to immediately be kind of call it large cap, mega cap, depending on who the company is.
Yeah, yeah. Where we have been talking about the market, particularly like the US being so sort of top heavy in the last few years with sort of the Mag 7.
Yeah, it's been hard.
Do you think potentially some of that could sort of recycle into some of these new IPOs?
I do. I mean, I think we saw some, last year we saw for the first time in probably the last kind of 3 years, we saw the Mag 7 not be as dominant relative to the contribution of tech. And that's a good thing for our fund, because if you think about kind of what the trust is really geared to doing, we're really focused on those kind of large cap, mid-cap opportunities and trying to catch that secular growth. I wouldn't be surprised if it continues to kind of persist with respect to the super mega caps, like not necessarily contributing as much, primarily because they've just been such massive outperformers, right? And by the way, they're amazing businesses. In my opinion, some of them are just pretty fairly valued. It'd be great if we see dollars come out of them, because it would really kind of help us with respect to our sweet spot. But ultimately, you know, the trust is really designed to perform in a variety of market conditions. So, I shouldn't need a bunch of, IPOs to go public for the trust to do well for our shareholders. You know, here again, we it is a diverse portfolio. It's something we really designed to handle a variety of market conditions. So hopefully that'll continue to persist.
Yeah, yeah. Where the sort of conversation around AI has changed in more recent months, what with the sort of software sell-off, do you think it is coming to that point where it is broadening out a bit more now?
Well, I think that what you're seeing is the early demonstrable examples of AI impacting business in a positive way, and that's been really tough for the software sector. And I don't know about what your own personal experience is with AI, but it's pretty incredible. I think, for a variety of workers, it's really a productivity enhancer. And really makes your day-to-day life, more efficient. Now, what do you do with the extra time? I have no idea for some people. But, I do think that I've been amazed, like some of the stuff we've even done internally, just with from a team perspective, I've just been blown away with just the amount of time saving we're getting from some of these kind of what I consider lightweight AI applications. By the way, we developed them ourselves because the user interface is so robust from a non-tech person. You can do a lot of stuff, just by saying, by a series of questioning and prompts. That I think the worry has been with respect to software. I think the concern is, do you see subscription renewals, that seat growth, does that start to not grow or actually potentially shrink given all the announcements from some of the AI companies? And that's put a lot of pressure on the software sector. Fortunately for us, we've been underweight enough for a long period of time now, just because we saw such good opportunities elsewhere. The valuations are starting to look pretty compelling, but I'll also tell you that, just because something looks compelling from a valuation perspective, if there is a structural shift in the marketplace, then you really have to rethink what you're willing to pay for a business.
Yeah. Do you think those concerns then could sort of overhang the sort of software as a service sector for a while still, that those valuations will continue to be depressed?
Well, I don't know on the valuation side, but I can tell you the concern side, I think that it's definitely a show me sector right now, in that I think investors want to see not only a solid results, but a path that shows that they're not, that these companies are not being impacted by artificial intelligence. And I'll also tell you, you know, not all sectors are created equal. We do have some exposure to software, but you know, I think that if you take a broad brush stroke of the sector, at if we just bucket everything into software, the sector is under a fair amount of pressure right now, like we haven't seen in a long time.
Yeah, how have your software holdings sort of fared throughout this? Are you a bit worried that, you know, some unforeseeable AI tool could come along?
100% is the answer to that question. I'm always worried, but that's just kind of what you get paid to do. But I would, in all seriousness, I think that, you know, you've seen this scenario whereby some of the more aggressive and growing AI companies put out press releases that basically acknowledge that they want to go into some of those spaces. And that puts a lot of pressure on the incumbent. Whether or not, you know, so look, not, you know, I have kind of a core belief that companies can do, call it, two or three things extremely well. So I don't think a company that says we're going to go into 15 different markets, yada, yada, yada. I think the reality is when it all is done and said, you know, they will probably enter five different, they'll try to do maybe whatever, three to five different things, and of which they'll probably do, you know, two or three of those things extremely well. But, you know, the mantra from investors has been, you know, sell and ask questions later. I think that, you know, there's a lot of worry and concern. And I will also tell you, on the positive side, the workflows associated with an enterprise are very important and very valuable. And just because you say you can remediate, I'll just use a cybersecurity example, a cybersecurity problem, there's a lot of stuff that goes with that once that remediation happens. There's notification, there's governance, there's all kinds of, you know, the data needs to go into a data warehouse, et cetera, et cetera. So there's a lot of other stuff, but right now people are valuing those workflows at not very valuable.
Yeah. Do you think we could see a similar sell-offs in other sectors at the moment that could potentially be sort of rife for AI disruption?
100%, and we've seen it. I mean, I work around, you know, some of my peers work in other sectors, and we've definitely seen, AI impact. You know, people kind of jokingly say, you know, the sector got AI'd. This is a very powerful secular technology that cuts across all horizontal markets. So it's something that has the applicability to really change businesses.
Yeah. Which other sectors do you see as being potentially vulnerable to disruption?
I mean, I don't really know, because I spend all my time in tech. I think there's some concern around, I've heard about, you know, some of the insurance related industries being under pressure just around the data side of things. But here again, you know, I would, you know, for people watching this show, I'm definitely not an expert. Unfortunately, they keep me pretty focused on technology, which is a pretty big sector to begin with.
Yeah. Yeah. Obviously, it seems like every company that you speak to at the moment is saying that they're, you know, a beneficiary of AI. How do you sort of distinguish between the actual adopters and the ones that are sort of putting on a bit?
I mean, so I think that all companies, you know, that basically our end markets sell to are definitely spending time understanding what AI means to their business. And that means that dollars are being spent to learn and to understand what can it mean to the business. So I think that's ubiquitous, because if you don't, you run the risk of just, you know, being really at a competitive advantage. That's a very difficult exercise. But what we'd like to see is, you know, demonstrable use cases of how a company really kind of implements a solution that helps solve, whether it's, you know, grow more sales, you know, take costs out, happier customers, kind of the three things the businesses really care about. And it runs the gamut. I hear again, you know, I would tell investors, it's still really early days here. You know, further along, but companies are doing a lot of learning. But I, you know, what you know, if my own experience with AI is any indication of the power, there's a lot of opportunity here.
Yeah. Going back to sort of the US as well, obviously, the US makes up the vast majority of your portfolio, around 90%.
Yeah.
Do you see that continuing to be as dominant as it has been in the past? What with some of the innovation that we're seeing in the places like China and for much cheaper? You know, is the U.S. still going to be the standout place?
I mean, the U.S. has led in technology for, you know, as long as I've been in the business, and I joined, you know, started in 2001. So I don't see that changing anytime soon. The other thing that, you know, and so two points I'd make. Just because a company is domiciled in the U.S. doesn't mean they generate all their revenues from the U.S. I think it's fair to say most of the public companies have, you know, that we deal with have large international exposures, because why wouldn't you do business globally? We live in a very global world. The second thing I would tell you is the receptivity of the U.S. investor and the U.S. funding sources, venture capital, is very different compared to other places in the world. So this notion of loss-making businesses in order to build market share and build moats around their business is something that really resonates with U.S. investors and obviously the venture capital community. I don't think that exists as much outside of the U.S. And if you're a company and you really want to raise capital, you probably want to go to a place where they are more receptive to this notion of spending to build your business with the profits coming later. And by the way, the profits for most of these businesses do come versus, you know, an environment where someone's going to say, I want you to be profitable next year. You know, here's half the size of the check. So some of it is just the lens that U.S. investors look at things. And some of it's a function of just a lot of capital needing to be deployed vis-a-vis, you know, whether it's venture, whether it's private equity.
Yeah. Do you see any other market that has anywhere near the same like risk appetite as the US at the moment? Or is it still going to be the sort of place where tech gravitates to?
I mean, I'm probably biased here because I worked in tech before I ran the trust, but the US is just so dialed in to the tech infrastructure. By the way, you know, the UK has, I say this all the time, it's amazing how many UK residents are in high level positions in the Silicon Valley. You know, the UK is a nation of tinkerers, right? If you go back and think about automobiles, if you think about, you know, airplanes, et cetera, et cetera. I just think that a lot of people go to the US because there's this pre-existing infrastructure of workers that if our idea is a good one and then we need to scale, they exist in larger numbers there. It doesn't mean they don't exist other places. They just probably don't have the scale. Now, to your point on China, you know, China obviously has a large population, very engineering, math focused. And, you know, we were very early investors in China. It's, you know, in 2002, we started investing the trust, or the team, not the trust. We didn't take over the trust to 2007, and I joined in 2009. But we were early investors in China. I think, you know, China's interesting. One of the challenges is just, you know, just the heavy-handedness of the government there. But they have a lot of really, really well-educated, talented employees.
Yeah. So were you invested in sort of China-domiciled companies? When did you sort of move away from those?
We moved away before the pandemic when the new regime came. We exited China. It was our timing was really, really good. And we did not like the current leadership Just in fairness, it was my predecessors. I worked with them, so I don't know. I don't remember the exact names that we owned, but we were early investors in a lot of the household names in in the Chinese tech companies.
Yeah, are there any companies there currently that you kind of like the looks of, but obviously you can't because of where it's domiciled?
Well, first of all, we can and we have, especially because of, some of the AI solutions. Right now we have a very small exposure to China, yeah. Extremely small.
Like you say, because a lot of companies list in the U.S., do you find that you can still invest in those companies, but just...
Depends on where, 100%. It just depends on where, here again, we're a global fund, so we can invest, around the globe. It just so happens that so many of the businesses that we're looking at happen to be headquartered in the U.S.
I touched on this at the beginning, the trust's sort of long-term performance. You've beaten sort of almost every other investment trust and open-ended fund. Has the closed-ended structure been part of that for you? Has that helped?
I think that the closed-ended structure has really allowed us flexibility when we see high periods of volatility. So I'm not worried about having to, liquidate a bunch of stock. We really like the closed-ended structure. It's something that we think our investors benefit from, and has really served us well over time. I mean, it's kind of all I know with respect to the product. It's something that, as we think about just the tools in our toolkit, the trust structure gives us more tools than we'd have otherwise.
Maybe just to close on, obviously investing in technology can be sort of a very volatile ride.
Yeah, you notice the gray hair.
and the last few weeks have sort of been testament to that with everything that's been happening. What would be your sort of like standout piece of advice that you would give to an investor in technology?
I really like that question a lot. Look, I would tell investors in general, invest in things you love and things you really know and things that change your life, right? If you think about in the morning, for a lot of people, they wake up, their alarm clock's been replaced by a smartphone, right? And a lot of those smartphones are, products made by Apple. And, so I'm really of that kind of Peter Lynch mindset where I tell individual investors, if there's a product, and by the way, my wife is amazing at this. She's so good at spotting, these early kind of companies that grow like weeds, and a lot of it is around things she's interested in. But, figure out, if you have a product you love, if you have a pair of shoes, whatever it is. But I really encourage people to, observe things. I can remember, I'm seeing it now, and by the way, we don't invest, but like I see On Cloud, the sneaker company, they're everywhere at my gym. And it used to be all Nike. Now it's Hoka. I hope I'm saying that correctly. And On Cloud. So, be an observer of the world, observe people. I'm always like watching it. I took the tube over here and I was watching how people use their cell phones on the tube. So, be observational. If there's a product or a service that, amazing customer service or an amazing product, kind of, let your own kind of filter be the direction that you want to go in as an individual investor.
Yeah. Have you ever bought a company because of that reason? You've heard people using it or you've had inspiration from like your real life?
I mean, I'd like to think we do more diligence than that.
That's a starting point.
But no, 100%. Are you kidding me? If I meet with a CFO or CEO or a head of I always say, tell me about three or four products you can't do your day without. I love to know what are products that are so germane to doing somebody's job. And the same thing exists, out in the, for consumers. If you think about it, if you think about, music and I have a son who's really interested in kind of EDM music, and he turned me on to this app called SoundCloud, and I really, really like it. I mean, I know I'm old for EDM, but I do really like a few of the bands. I think it's a really interesting product. We own Spotify, which here again, it's music, it's customizable. I definitely 100%, like a lot of you never, in my job, you never know where your next idea is coming from. So there's a serendipitous aspect to it. So put yourself in an environment so you can observe. Put yourself in an environment so you can learn. You know, it's kind of why I really enjoy being around young people to understand, like, what are the products and services they love.
Brilliant. Yeah. Well, yeah, thank you very much for joining us,
Mark. You're welcome.
And if you enjoyed today's show, remember to subscribe to Investment Trust Insider for all the latest on Allianz Tech and the goings on in the closed end space. Goodbye.